meetings, you know, and and it's the truth, you know, because the bottom line is I don't like everybody here. I do not, you know, and not everybody likes me. And that's the way it's supposed to be in a world of very different people and different personalities. But the difference is that I allow you to be here and you allow me to be here. You know, and I allow you to have your opinion and you allow me to have our opinion. And the group conscience helps you take care of that. I mean, I've been, and I'm sure you have had them too. We've had really heated group discussions. Babies allowed in the meeting, babies not allowed in the meeting. You know, the smoking's non-smoking thing when you could smoke in the state of California. I mean, very heated, very opinionated stuff was going on. We had a lady bringing a dog to a meeting. Oh my God, this was a huge group conscience. And people were coming unglued because she had this little teeny weeny dog. And she had a purse and she kept the dog in the purse. The dog never did nothing. The dog never barked. She made a lot more ruckus than the dog did. The dog never did a thing. But it irritated some people that there was a dog at the meeting. Again, they had their rule book of no dogs at the meeting. And so people were going to take a group conscience about it. Now, I thought it was kind of silly, especially since the dog did nothing. And so my friend who was very animate, and this was my very, very good friend in Al-Anon, was one of the no dog at the meeting group conscience people. She was telling me, well, she turned to me and she goes, well, Arsene, how would you feel about it if I brought my dog to the meeting? What if we all start bringing our dogs to the meeting? Now, she has a dog that's about yay big. She is a huge dog. So I told her, I said, Kathy, if you can fit that dog in a purse and bring it to the meeting, then by God, you bring that dog to the meeting. But the bottom line was, we all got to talk about how we felt about the dog at the meeting, and some people cared and some people didn't care. And then we did the thing. We took the group conscience, you know, and then it was fine for the dog to come to the meeting as the group conscience worked out that particular night. And nobody hated each other, you know, and the dog people who didn't want it didn't break off and go to another meeting. Because the group conscience is God expresses himself in our group conscience. So it's not my vote, it's not your vote. If you really believe that God is expressing himself in your group conscience, then it's God's vote. It's the way that, you know, that's just the way God's talking to you that particular day about how it can go. Now, I know that's not always the case because, boy, I've been to meetings when they've stacked the deck. You know, when they know we're going to vote on something, so all the people that don't normally go to that meeting, you know, show up at that meeting and blah, blah, blah. And I've been at meetings where we've taken the group conscience and the next week they bring it up again because the vote didn't go their way. You know, again, we're sick people here. You know, and you're going to run into that because I don't want to paint this picture of it's always just the group conscience always works out perfectly. It doesn't. It doesn't always work out perfectly. But for the most part, when we're all being honest and truthful, then it works out. It works out exactly perfectly like it's supposed to be. But if you have your people that are going to manipulate, try and control, and try and make it happen, they might make it happen for a little bit. But what ends up happening to that meeting when it's controlled by certain people? The meeting starts to fall apart. I've seen it happen time and time again. People just quit coming because they don't want what you got. They don't need to be manipulated or controlled or made things happen a certain way. So in a way, God's conscience is still working in that meeting. You know, people think they're getting around him, but they're not. There's no getting around God. And I believe with all my heart that Al-Anon and Alcoholics Anonymous is totally God-inspired. It's just the way it is here. How else could we all get along and all come together and all make this stuff happen? You know, if there wasn't this really divine presence, you know, really looking out for the whole deal. And I really believe that, you know, that God is the absolute total person that's in charge of this deal. I remember the first time I worked, Al-Anon outside of my meeting, and I came in Al-Anon in June, and I was a hostile whiner when I got here, and I remember being in line at Christmas time, and it was bananas, 2 days before Christmas, and you know how long the lines are, and Earl then was about 3 years old, and I was trying to keep a hold of him, and I had all these, you know, things that I was buying, and I was at May Company, and I had all this stuff stacked up, and Earl kind of ran off to the corner, and I ran off to get him, and I came back, and I got back in line. Well, when I got back in line, this woman had taken cuts in front of me. You know, she'd stepped in front, and I turned to her, and I said, I'm sorry, you took my place. And she said, you weren't here when I got here. And I said, well, I had to go get my son. So the man in front of her, I said, well, you tell her that I was standing here. And he doesn't want to participate. He knows nothing, you know. And so she refused to move, and so I start steaming, because I just know how to get mad and be mad at people and whatever. And then I remember, you know, the traditions, you know, and I just start thinking about, you know, we practice these principles in all our affairs. And so what I was able to do was I just turned her over. I didn't, you know, I just let it go. How important is it? The things that I've learned here. And when we got up to the front of the line, she had quite a few packages and stuff that was in, I can't remember what she was buying, but it was like those slippery packages, you know, it was like in just slippery stuff. And when she went to go put it up on there, she had like 15 or 20 of them. And when she went to put it up, all her packages just went. Now, my first thing is, that's what you get. God's going to get you, you know. And then my second thing was, you know, we practice these principles in all our affairs, you know. And so what I started doing was I started helping her pick up her packages. You know, because that's the next right indicated thing to do. Because my thought is always going to be the negative one. God's getting you for being mean to me. When in reality, your packages fell down. And I had an opportunity to practice these principles in all my affairs, so I helped her pick up her packages. And after I helped her pick up her packages, she started crying. This perfect stranger woman started crying in this thing. And she hugged me and told me how sorry she was and how tense she was and all the family problems that she was having and blah, 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 you know, and stuff. And we're hugging each other in the store, you know, and I understand. And has she ever been to Al-Anon, you know, and we're off and we're running, you know, and stuff like that. You know, and that was the deal for me. It works outside the meetings. You know, it works outside the meetings as well if you take it with you. You know, it's so easy to stand here in the meetings and work it in the meetings. Just a piece of cake. But taking it outside, you know, that's the deal. And applying the traditions to your family life. The common good comes first. You know, the ultimate good for everybody, you know, is a loving God in my house. You know, it's not about what's going to make my husband be okay or what's going to make me be okay. Sometimes we have to take a group conscience in our house. I'm always amazed. You know, we had four people living in my house. And it never blows my mind how three people could be happy, happy, happy. You know, we're just having a good time. The fourth person walks in. Could be me, could be my husband, could be one of my children in a bad mood. Now, isn't it just amazing? I don't know how your house is, but one person and three people equals sucky. I mean, it's just amazing. Now, you've got three happy. Now, how does three happy get overruled by one crappy? You know, but it's just the way that the negative part of it works. Because all I know is that we're all blah, you know, because this negative person has come in, and what are we trying to do? We're trying to fix him, trying to find out what's going on with him, and of course you can't fix someone who's in a bad mood, and we're trying to do all that kind of stuff, and it turned around. And so our family kind of developed the philosophy that conveniently for us, there was four of us. So each of us had a 25 equal percent share in the family. And that's what you get, pretty much. Now, sometimes I know there's times when you're going to have family members that are going to need more than their 25%. But for the most part, that's kind of what we based it on. You get your 25%, but you're not sucking the other 75% in behind your bad crap anymore. And that applied to me as well. That absolutely applied to me as well, you know, because I'm just as capable of taking my bad attitude home and trying to dump it on those guys. You know, so taking the traditions home, working the deal in your family, these are all the tools that are available to us to do, you know, if we're willing to do it. You know, and I think right now here's maybe a good place to stop and take a little break if we need it, and we'll come back in about, what, 10 or 15 minutes? I have to start every time. Hi, I'm Marcine. In case you don't know, I need to start out that way. Grateful member of Al-Anon. And congratulations to Ruth for her $112. I wish I could give you each $112, you know. Okay, so anyway. We have a gal like that wins money all the time, and she wins every friggin' prize there is. I mean, it drives us all crazy, and I think she does it on purpose just to irritate the bejeebies out of us. So I love when Joyce was talking about getting the obscene phone call and thinking the guy was in pain. It's so Al-Anon. My dad, before he died, he had emphysema, too, and I got an obscene phone call one time, too, and this guy was just like, and I'm like, Dad, is that you? You know? I'm sure that's not the response he was looking for, you know, but... but you don't know, you know, and we are rescuey type people, so... Okay. Okay, moving right along here, at least we... totally go off the path. You know, the next thing, you know, I had on my list here was slogans. And the slogans are just absolutely, you know, I used to think, you know, when you walk into your first meeting, they're on the wall, how hokey is this? You know, it's just like, oh my gosh. And, but you know, what I found for me is, you know, is I just had to pick a couple of them. You know, I just wouldn't, you know, my sponsor said, you pick a couple of these, you know, because those are like your lifelines when you're desperate. You know, when you don't have anything else to hold on to, you know, a slogan will take you through places. You know, and it's a simple thing. It's a simple thing for very, very complicated people. You know, and I have complicated problems going on in my life, and it blows my mind how something as simple as live and let live can let me move on to the next place. You know, one of my favorites, too, is let go and let God. And that became my favorite because in my family, it's not let go and let God. In my personal family, my family says let go and let Larsine. That's what they say to remind me that I am being God in their life, you know, and I need that reminder every so often, because that's just because I'm right there. They're having an issue and a problem, and I just got to rescue them and make it be okay or whatever, and, you know, oh, yeah, we forgot. We're supposed to let go and let Larsine, and it is. It's let go and let God take care of it, and you know, and I can't say enough good stuff about all these simple things that are here. You know, it just seemed like it was all so hokey. You know, and just also trivia, you know, compared to the massive, massive problems, you know, that I was dealing with when I got here. And it's amazing, you know, easy does it. You know, keep it simple. You know, just those simple, simple things that just make it that much easier for me to do things. I'm the one who complicates the bejesus out of everything that I touch, you know, because I think I have to make it this much more of a deal than it actually needs to be. And, you know, and again, one more time, you know, I love, you know, and it was so helpful to me, too, again, you know, on how Al-Anon works. You know, there's the whole thing on all the slogans are in here, and then the words behind them and exactly the meaning that goes on behind that. You know, if you haven't read it lately, I can't, you know, implore you enough to kind of take a look at it again, you know, to put those kinds of things back in your life, you know, because it's easy for me to get away from. I think I've graduated onto a higher level of Al-Anon, you know, the slogans are for the new stupid people, you know, type of a thing. You know, again, how my crazy mind works, and the deal is that, you know, is that they'll help you, and go back and read about those things, and one more time, keeping it simple, and, you know, and I work in a very busy, just crazy office, and they're always amazed, you know, that I have this even temper about everything that's going on, and it's because I have the slogans, keep it simple, easy does it, how important is it, you know, it's just stay focused on those types of things, you know, and most of the slogans are, what, 3 or 4 words? You know, but boy, how much meaning is packed into that? You know, and I can sit here and talk to you for hours about the slogans, but just saying them, just the words by themselves, you know, they're the ones that pack all the meaning and can make such a difference. You know, the next thing I have on my list is living with sobriety. And, you know, and like I said, you know, when the alcoholic got sober for me, it was all about him. It's all about the alcoholic. Heck, it was all about the alcoholic when he was drinking. You know, and I always call it the alcoholic show. You know, it's kind of what's going on all the time. And like I say, it's because they do big stuff. You know, they just do big stuff. But what I, you know, sobriety, what I've come to learn is the alcoholic's gift. You know, that is definitely their gift. And what it is it's a real blessing. You know, I don't ever want to put down anybody's sobriety or act like it's not an important thing. And I know some people don't have really quality sobriety. I know other people have wonderful sobriety. You know, sobriety is just that. You know, it's like my friend Crazy Gene used to say, you know, if you take a drunken horse thief and you sober him up, he just steals a better quality of horse. You know, there's the difference. You know, they have to be willing to work the principles in all their programs, just like I'm willing to work the principles in all my programs. And I think sobriety is a wonderful thing, and I do not take it for granted. It is a special, special gift. I know that it's my husband's gift, but he shares that with me. You know, because when he's sober and he's working the steps and doing the deal, I get the benefit of that as his wife. You know, and I am really, really grateful for that. You know, and if you do happen to have that blessing of sobriety in somebody you love, you know, you know how special it is. You know what an absolutely wonderful, wonderful thing it is. And again, one more time, I can't say why my husband got to get sober and somebody else's didn't. You know, I don't know what the deal is about that. I just know my husband accepted the gift of sobriety, and then he works his program, and he goes to meetings, and he does the things that he needs to do to maintain that sobriety. And I do not take that for granted. I am very, very grateful. I also know it's a day-at-a-time deal. It's just one day at a time. I never take for granted the fact that he is sober, that just because he is today, that he's going to be tomorrow. I know that he's doing the things that he's supposed to do. You know, and what's important for me, too, is, you know, for a long time I took on, you know, like it was kind of like, even though I knew sobriety was his deal, you know, I'm always kind of watching off the sidelines here to make sure, you know, because, you know, what do you do when they don't go to meetings like they're supposed to go? You know, I know I'm supposed to, you know, be a red flag waver here. And, you know, I kind of liken that to him having a booger in his nose. You know, as his wife, if I see my husband with a booger in his nose, I should point out to him, honey, you need to wipe your nose. You know, it's not my job to take it out. You know, it's just not there. You know, And the same thing with his sobriety. You know, when I think that he's not working his program or going to his meetings or he needs to talk to a sponsor, I may feel compelled to tell him, you know, boy, you've kind of been disgruntled lately or something, you know. Do you think you need to go to a meeting? And I know pretty much probably what he's going to tell me to do is because what I'm going to tell him to do when he says the same thing to me. But as a loving wife and a caring wife, you know, I feel there's a certain responsibility. And again, I got the 3-minute rule. I can tell him how I feel about what I think is going on, but the results are up to him. The action is up to him. You know, I can point out that I see something's going on and then I got to let it go. You know, and he does the same thing for me. He does the same thing for me. And, you know, and again, you know, it's, and I'm always trying, you know, what is it about us that makes us want to compensate for them all the time? You know, when my boys were teenager, as their hair got longer, mine got shorter. You know, I mean, it was just kind of like someone in this house has to have short hair. You know, I know somebody does. And they're not doing it, so I volunteered, you know, because again, it's my compensating skills for that all the time. Butch and I and a bunch of us took a ballroom dancing class. We thought this would be great fun. All sober people, all people in the program, and there was about 8-10 couples, and we all signed up for ballroom dancing. And we thought that this would just be a really kind of fun outside activity to do. Well, let me tell you, the very first night we lost one couple immediately. I mean, they were gone. They just weren't even there. And there's all these dumb rules about ballroom dancing. There's a lot of, the first dumb rule they have in ballroom dancing, the guy leads. Stupid, stupid rule, you know. Who came up with that? You know, I mean, because, see, when my husband, he's this way. When he doesn't know what he's doing, he doesn't do it, you know. Now, that's opposite to me, you know, because all I know is we're on the dance floor, music's playing, we're supposed to be moving. And if he's not taking me, then I'm taking him. Because I am not going to be the only couple on the floor looking like we don't know what we're doing. And subsequently, we never learn how to ballroom dancing because I have to take the lead all the time. And it just got crazy. And then because we all knew each other, you know, the couples did and stuff like that, you could hear all the little bickering things going on. Well, you know, if you would do what you were supposed to be doing. And then the fatal thing happened. The instructor of the class took me ballroom dancing. Now, this guy is a ballroom dancer. He is a professional ballroom dancer. And let me tell you, when someone is leading you who knows what they're doing, because I am not a ballroom dancer, this guy had me looking good. I mean, I was all over the place, whoa, you know, and this, and doing the tango, and I don't know how to do any of this, but this guy knows how to lead. So when he brings me back to poor, pathetic Butch, you know, and when I'm not looking good anymore, guess whose fault it is? If he was doing what he was supposed to be doing, I would be looking good. And one more time, I trying to compensate, you know, for him, trying to make the difference, trying to make him look like he's so everybody thinks that he's doing good. So anyway, what ends up happening is all us couples, and we are all having our own little fights, calling each other names. This was our extracurricular fun activity we signed up for, don't forget. You know, and we're all just, you know, you hear all this bickering going on, and obviously the instructor heard the bickering going on. Because the instructor says, okay, everybody stop, we are going to change partners. And it's amazing how polite we all became immediately when we were dancing with somebody else's husband or wife, how cooperative we started to become, you know. And one more time, you know, what the deal is, you know, how much kindness and how much tolerance and patience I'm willing to have for your husband or the stuff that's going on with you, yet my husband, who I love with all my heart and soul, I'm mad at him. He's letting me down. He's not doing what he's supposed to be doing, yet your husband's trying. You know, and again, one more time, you know, he's doing the best that he can, and I have to give him credit for that. You know, my husband's a really good person and a really gentle soul and kind beyond words and very, very wonderful with me. And, you know, and I don't know how sometimes he tolerates all the stuff, you know, that I do because I'm crazy and I'm wacky and I'm running off and I'm doing my deal or whatever. You know, but I've learned a lot of things from the alcoholic, you know, and don't close your mind, you know, to the things that you can learn from the alcoholic because the pain that has happened there. I remember one time we were on a plane, we were flying somewhere, and I was reading, you know, because I'm the good Al-Anon person, and I was reading my books and my Al-Anon books and becoming a spiritual giant on the flight. Don't ask me why I needed to become one on this flight. And so I'm reading all my stuff, and then my husband's reading his stupid Louis L'Amour Western over here. But I'm becoming a spiritual giant while he's just reading trivial crap. And the drink the stewardess comes down with the drink cart, and he was thirsty and I was thirsty, but we were both fairly engrossed in our books, and somehow she managed to get past us without giving us a beverage. And so, and my husband looked up and go, well, where'd the stewardess go? I didn't get a drink. And I go, oh, she missed us and stuff. And so my husband said, well, I want something to drink. Well, I have been reading these spiritual books. I am a giant now. And I have decided, you know, how important is it? So I say to my husband, in 1,000 years from now, who will care if we had a drink or not? You know, and my husband says to me, he goes, I don't care about 1,000 years from now. I'm living in the now, and I'm thirsty now, and I want to drink now. And, you know, and one more time, you know, these are the things that I get to learn from my husband. You know, I like to think sometimes, you know, my Al-Anon brain is way beyond the alcoholic little pee thing going on in there. You know, and he has profound thoughts, you know, and wonderful things because he lives the truth. He lives in the now. He just lives it the way that it is. He's not trying to impress anybody. You know, he's just trying to stay sober one day at a time. You know, and those are the things that I've gotten from my husband. You know, that's the bottom line. His sobriety is the most important thing, and that's what he works towards. And that was another thing that was very difficult for me. You know, I was always secondary to alcohol, secondary to, you know, all the drugs and all the other crap, and now we're sober, and now I'm secondary to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'm sure a sponsor said, go home and tell your wife that. She'll just love it. And, because I didn't like it. And that's what I thought. And I spent a lot of time, you know, that first couple years my husband was sober, trying to tell an alcoholic why he shouldn't go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. You know, the thing that saved his life, I tried to take away from him because it still wasn't about me. It wasn't about me. You know, and to me today, living with sobriety is a special thing. I am so grateful for that. Totally undeserving of it. I have absolutely no doubt about that, but I am so grateful for it. It's a big, big deal in my life. And if you have it in your life, you know, and again, even if you don't have it in your life, I hope you go to Open Alcoholics Anonymous meetings to see what sober people are like. You know, because there's so much there. There is a lot of laughter there. When I first started coming to Al-Anon, and then I wanted to become an alcoholic, I thought, boy, because they're having fun over there. That's where you hear all the laughter going on. Then it occurred to me we could laugh in Al-Anon. You know, and then sometimes now, we used to have a meeting where they had the AA meeting on the other side of the room and the Al-Anon meeting on our side of the room, and we would hear them laugh really loud out there. So even though we weren't discussing anything funny, we would all laugh really loud, so they would think that we were having just as much fun as they were having. You know, because the fun is here if you want to have it. You know, if you want to be in the sad crying room or whatever, you know, yeah, there's a time to be there. But basically, you know, the joy that's here, you know, the joy that's in sobriety, it is absolutely positively there. And, you know, and you need to go and you need to hear about, you know, and it isn't about them being sober either. You know, you can be happy here. I've seen people be happy here. I know that living with active alcoholism is no picnic, and I know it is no fun ride. You know, I know it's a really, really, really hard road to go. But, you know, for whatever reason, if you choose to stay there, you know, then that's a choice that you make. And there's nothing wrong with loving an alcoholic. I've learned that here, too. And I've been with people I sponsor whose husbands are still drinking. And you know what? They're really nice guys. I always like them. I always think they're just the sweetest guys. But unfortunately, when they start ingesting the alcohol, they have a huge personality change. And that's the deal that goes on with them. And they are not bad people. You know, and I got to learn that from coming to meetings and going to Open Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. Alcoholics are not the enemy. It's the disease of alcoholism, the family disease of alcoholism that is. You know, prayer and meditation. Boy, that's just like, that's become a steadfast thing for me. You know, and I was so away from prayer and so away from meditation. You know, I just didn't want anything to do with it. You know, I told you about, you know, the first time I actually offered up that prayer to God. And, you know, when I was standing in my backyard because I didn't know how to do it. You know, so I just told God who I am and where I live. You know, and to please try and show me the way to go. In one of the AA books, one of the, like, Dr. Bob and the Old Timers, or one of those books, I can't remember which one, but I remember reading a story about Sister Ignatia, you know, and how she was in the, you know, she was with Dr. Bob when he was running that hospital in Akron, Ohio, when they were taking all the alcoholics through, and there's a story about her, and there's about, you know, this alcoholic that's just chasing her all over the place, you know, because he's having a really hard time with the prayer thing, and, you know, and how God won't hear his prayers, you know, and stuff, and Sister Ignatia just keeps telling him, just pray, you know, and stuff, and finally the guy, the drunk's just so frustrated, he goes to her, well, how in the heck am I going to know that God's even hearing my prayers? And she goes, don't worry about it, because there's nothing that God likes to hear better than a prayer from a stranger. You know, and that helped me say my first prayer, you know, because it was a complete prayer from a stranger. But I believe that God hears prayers, you know. They're not always answered the way that we think, you know, that maybe they should be, and that's why you think your prayer isn't being answered. You know, sometimes the answer is yes, sometimes the answer is no, sometimes the answer is maybe. You know, it's just the way that it is. And again, the seemingly bad things that are going on in your life can turn out to be, you know, be what turns out to be for the better good when you get down the path a little bit further. You know, there's this poem that, if any of you guys know, you know, Winnie Eddy, you know, when Winnie was alive, and she was absolutely positively one of my favorite Al-Anon people of all time to be around. She was just this just fabulous, wonderful, wonderful lady, and, you know, and she always, you know, would talk about, you know, the tapestry, you know, that God's sewing this tapestry, and he sees it from his end, and we just see all the knots and the threads from our bottom part, you know, and it's not until we get to get up there that we can see why all the threads were necessary for our life to be the way that it was, you know, and there's the deal. You know, to a certain extent, I think there's a plan, you know, for all of us, and I think really what God's plan is for us is to be happy, joyous, and free. I think that's God's plan. You know, how we get about that is that's our plan. You know, that's why God gives us free choice. You know, we get to make decisions about our life and how we want to go and where we want to go. You know, but what does God want for everybody? Happy, joyous, and free. I really do believe that with all my heart. And so he gives us all these opportunities, you know, to be able to do these things. But, you know, again, the negative disease of alcoholism, no happy, no joyous, no free, not allowed. You know, and so that gets kind of shoved away, and you forget that God is there. You know, and God speaks to me all kinds of ways, all kinds of places, all kinds of people, all kinds of things. And I remember one time we were doing a rafting trip down in Yosemite, and the water was very low, so it was a very difficult rafting trip because, you know, you hit across the rocks and you'd have to, you know, get out of the water. And the water in Yosemite is frigging cold. It's like melted snow water, you know, so it's ice water. Now, I am, you know, already, you know, as for a person that camps, you know, and does the hiking like me, you wouldn't think I was so bug phobia and, you know, all those kinds of things that I have going on. But I don't like the cold water either. I don't like sleeping on the ground, don't like any of the hard stuff that goes with camping. Now, the convenient thing about being the only woman in a family of guys is you can make them do stuff that women don't have to do because you got three guys to do it. So we'd be in this raft, and of course we'd hit the rocks. I'd refuse to get out of the boat, so they'd have to carry the boat with me in it. That's when they started calling me Larsopatra. That was favorite. I like that a lot. Oh, Larsopatra. We must take Larsopatra across the, you know. My family is a lot of fun. But anyway, this raft trip ended up being like twice as long as it was supposed to be, and it was very hot. It's in the summertime. It gets really hot in Yosemite, and I'm just slamming down the Diet Cokes. I mean, I'm just dying of thirst here and just drinking and drinking and drinking. We're about halfway through this deal. Now, it's only supposed to be an hour and a half raft trip, and we're 3 hours into this trip, and we're still got a ways to go yet. And I've drank, I don't know, three or four or five, you know, Diet Pepsis. There's bathroom time coming up here, folks, and I've got huge toilet issues, which I have told you about already, and I do not remove my pants in the woods. Just don't do it. Just don't do it. It's just, because there are insecty, crawly things and all kinds of stuff that could actually touch this lily white butt, and it's just not going to be allowed to happen, and that's my big deal, but when your bladder's going to burst, it's going to burst, and again, you know, I'm maybe 2 years in Al-Anon, there's no cell phones then, you know, or any of that kind of stuff, and I'm in the middle of Yosemite, and I'm with the alcoholic and two little kids, you know, not an Al-Anon there for me to talk to, so, you know, again, I go to my toolbox. What does my sponsor say? When there's nobody else, you go to God. You just go to God. So I started praying to God. God, I got to go pee. I'm scared. What do I do? You know, and I heard God say in my head, go pee. Just go. Just go pee. That simple. You know, God is a man of very few words. And I heard the words, go pee. So I take a beach towel with me, and I tell my husband I'm going to go in the woods and go pee. Well, he is not going to miss this experience. I mean, this has never happened on the face of the planet before, so he goes, I'll go with you, I'll hold the towel for you then, because he knows what a deal this is for me. Now, stupid me, I have a one-piece bathing suit on, you know, and shorts and all this stuff. Now, what do I know? Because I never go pee in the woods, so I have no experience about this. And so I take everything off, you know. Now, alcoholic women have since told me how you're supposed to yank the crotch way away, you know, and go to the bathroom, you know. So if you want to tell me that now, I already know. Thank you, thank you. But I'm a newbie. I didn't know about it then, you know. So I ended up taking everything off, and here I am butt naked in the woods doing my thing, watching the pee go down the little road wherever it goes. And I'm being very, very proud of myself, you know, and saying the serenity prayer the whole time, you know, God grant me the serenity, you know, doing the deal here, kind of keeping an eye out for bugs just in case, you know, and all of a sudden I felt myself being watched. I mean, I felt myself being watched, and I look up and there's my husband just peering down at me over there, and I look up at him and he goes, I am so proud of you. And I was was so proud to be an Al-Anon, you know. I mean, I just, you know, all the meetings all paid off, you know, right at that particular moment. Just totally paid off for me, you know, because one more time, it's the big deal that I make it be. It's just the big deal that I make it be. And I'm still not real fond of going, you know, bathroom in the woods or anything. It's not my favorite thing to do anymore. But one more time, you know, if that's what's put in front of me to do, I'm able to do it. That must be the next right thing for me to be, because this is where all the path has led me to go to this way. And again, it's just, you know, one more time, over and over and over again. And constantly I doubt the power of prayer. Even though over and over and over it has been shown to me, you know, more times than I care to tell you, how the power of prayer absolutely positively will take me through to the other side. Yet every time I doubt it, every time I'm still fearful. You know, I don't know when that goes away or when that absolutely stops, but the difference is that I'm willing to do it. I'm willing to say the prayer and then take the step in there. And that's just what gets to happen for me. And God talks to us through other people, too. You know, I believe that with all my heart and soul. And God, don't you just hate it when you get the meeting from the moron in the meeting? I mean, I just, you know, the person you hate the most is the person that's got the message for you that day. You know, because that's how God works. That's exactly how God works. Because nobody is an idiot. Everybody has something to share if you open your ears and hear it. But how many messages are you missing because you don't like the messenger? You know, and I don't ever want to be that way anymore. I, you know, when people get up, I pay them the respect to listen to what they've, you know, what they share. And if they're sharing something good that helps me, wonderful. And if they're not, again, take what you like and leave the rest. Just because that particular thing doesn't help me doesn't mean it isn't helping Betty or Bob or Cindy or whoever else needs to hear it at the time. And it doesn't mean that a week from now I won't remember what that person said and maybe that's when I need to hear it. You know, so you never know where it's going to come from. The other thing that's really big for me in this program, that is huge for me in this program, is forgiveness. And just never underestimate the power of forgiveness. Never underestimate it. You know, because forgiving is not forgetting. It's letting go of the hurt. And that's a big, big deal for me. Because like I said, you know, growing up in an alcoholic home, Al-Anon never told me, you know, that it was okay, you know, or never tries to make that be okay. You know, that my sister died was okay. It never tries to do that. But the bottom line is that what is. You know, and I have to learn to let go of that pain because it just stays with you. It just stays with you and stays with you and generates, you know, again, the bad feelings and all that stuff just keeps on going and going and going. And I love what it says in this book about forgiveness. I mean, this is probably the most powerful thing that I think that is in this book. That's on this page, and I have to read it to you guys because I mean I've got it clipped out, I've got it at work, I've got it everywhere. It's such a big deal for me. It's just a few paragraphs, but it says forgiveness. Resentment will do nothing except tear us apart inside. No one ever found serenity through hatred. No one truly recovered from the effects of alcoholism by harboring anger or fear or by holding on to grudges. Hostility keeps us tied to the abuses of the past. Even if the alcoholic is long gone from our lives or has refrained from drinking for many years, we too need to learn to detach. We need to step back from the memories of alcoholic behavior that continue to haunt us. We begin to detach when we identify the disease of alcoholism as the cause of the behavior and recognize that our own ongoing struggle with unpleasant memories is an effect of that disease. We too must find within us compassion for the alcoholic who suffered from this terrible illness. Each of us is worthy of love, and each of us is doubly blessed when we are able to dig down our past grievances and resentments, no matter how justified we may feel in harboring them, and find within ourselves the recognition of that part of the other person that is always and will be lovable. How better could we learn that we ourselves are eternally and irrevocably lovable than by recognizing that same quality in everyone else around us? And then it just goes on to say at the end, forgiveness is no favor. Forgiveness is no favor. We do it for no one but ourselves. We simply pay too high a price when we refuse to forgive. Lingering resentments are like acid eating away at us. Rehearsing and re-rehearsing old injuries robs us of all that is precious. Shame never liberated a single spirit, and self-righteousness never softened a heart. Can we afford to perpetuate such self-destructiveness? Surely we can make better use of our time and energy. Although we may despise what others have done, if we keep in mind that everything we are now trying to do has the goal of healing us, we are bound to decide that the best thing we can do for ourselves is to forgive. And I mean, the first time I read forgiveness is no favor, I mean, that was like a totally unbelievable concept for me. Because see, I always think if I forgive you, I'm being the bigger person. You know, that's my gift to you, when in reality, it's my gift to me. It is no favor. We do it for nobody but ourselves. You know, and that's the deal for me. And that's what allows me to be able to forgive, because I'm not doing it for you. I'm not letting you off the hook. I'm letting me off the hook. No more. Just no more. It's going to stop here. And the only way it can stop is when you forgive so you can move on. And again, one more time, I know there's abusive people in your life, you know, and I mean, again, you get to make the choices of what you're going to tolerate and what you're not going to tolerate. But if you don't forgive, it'll eat you. It'll eat you up and spit you out. And again, the same thing like when my dad died. I thought the deal was over and he didn't have any more power over my life. And he had plenty of power over my life because I wouldn't let it go and I wouldn't forgive him. You know, when I learned how to forgive here, it just set it free. It just totally set it free. And I just, you know, and I just have such a good feeling about my dad today. And that's a good thing. It's a really good thing. Now, the other thing I have down here is detachment and turning it over. You know, and again, that was another big deal for me. I remember the first time I turned my husband over after he was sober, because we were doing the what's the matter with me, nothing game. I don't know if you guys ever play that, but, you know, obviously something's the matter, so you say, what's the matter, and he says nothing, and then grumble, 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 well, what's the matter, and, well, you know, nothing. So we were doing that for a while, because, of course, I want to fix it and make it be all better. And so after we did this for 10 or 15 minutes, you know, I just said, okay. Fine. I called my sponsor. She said, well, just turn him over to God. Okay, how do you do that? You just give him to God. And so when you start thinking that there's something wrong with him, remember that you turned it over to God. Because turning it over is a big part of detachment for me. Because, see, I just can't detach. I got to give you to somebody. I have to know that somebody's watching you. I mean, it's very important for me to know that you are not all out there unsupervised, you know. So I will give you to God. I will let God watch you. And so I turned him over to God. And no sooner, I said, fine, and I hung up the phone and I did that. A couple of times it popped back into my mind. And about 10 or 15 minutes later, he walks into the kitchen and tells me he wants to talk about what's bothering him. And I'm like, forget it. I turned you over to God. You're going to have to talk to God now. I mean, that's just the way it is. That's where you're going now, buddy. You had your chance with me. You blew it. And because when I turn you over, you're gone. You got to go. And again, you know, another tool, just another tool. But it's really important for me to give you to somebody. I have to know that somebody's watching you. And I like it when I know God's watching you. I mean, there's just a real comfort. You know, I used to, you know, what I found out what God and I really have in common is that we all love the same people. You know, and it's really important for me to know that God loves my husband, loves my children, you know, loves people that I know that are struggling in the program, you know, and that he's watching out for them. You know, and I give them the best that I have to give them, but I don't give them all of me anymore. I just give them what it is mine to give, and then I let God do the rest of the stuff. And so detachment and turning over kind of go hand in hand together with me. The other thing I have down here is acceptance. God, how huge is acceptance in this program? I mean, isn't that really what it's all about? Just accepting things as they are, you know, is a huge relief. Not as I want them to be, not as I think they should be. Not, you know, the house I think I should have or the car that I think I should have, but being grateful for the things that I actually do have in my life. My husband and I, a couple months ago, talked at a family afterwards meeting where they have Al-Anons and AAs. They call it a Chapter 5 meeting, and we split a pitch at this meeting, and how they do it is the Al-Anon talks for 10 minutes, the AA talks for 10 minutes, they take a 10-minute coffee break, and then they have 10-minute kind of question and answer. And this AA guy got up, and he was talking about, he'd been sober about, I don't know, a couple of years, and just how he's always whining. He's never been happy with what he's had in his life. You know, he never has the right girlfriend. He never has the right job, you know. And he goes, well, I guess I pushed the limit, he says, because my sponsor's just sick and tired of hearing about it. So he says, from now on, when people come up to me and say, how are you? I am supposed to tell them I'm better than I think I am. And I just absolutely love that. You know, because how much are we really better than we think we are? You know, we're the first people to beat ourselves up or think we don't have this or think we don't have that. When you really want to look around and see what you really have, you really want to stop a minute and count all your blessings, you will find out that you're better than you think you are. You know, and I think that all the time when I start feeling sorry for myself. You know, Larcine, go look at all the shoes you have in your closet. Whoa, you know, I mean, and not that things fix you or anything else like that. But I mean, I just have to stop sometimes. I am blessed in so many ways. But I want to think I don't have enough, or I want to think I should have more. I want to justify why this is going on or that's going on. When in reality, every single solitary day, I'm better than I think I am. Every single solitary day. And so that's been a thought that's just been going through my mind over and over and over again, is that I'm better than I think I am. And I'm grateful for that. And then the next thing I have on my list is amends. You know, and I told you about the first amends I made to my husband last night. Again, not the very best amends that you can make. You know, and I'm still, you know, saying I'm sorry is a really hard thing for me, you know, because I'm always so self-righteous all the time. And every time I say I'm sorry to anybody in my family now, they all feign a heart attack. You know, they all do the, oh my God, you know, Darcene's admitting she made a mistake or whatever. You know, but I remember when my husband was getting ready to make his amends to me, and I was very excited about this. It was like a Saturday or something. He goes, you know, I need to sit down and make my amends to you. And this was like during the day, and I'm like, ho, we're not doing this now. You know, we're going to wait till tonight, and the kids are in bed, you know, and we'll do it tonight. That's when I want to do it. You know, so I got the kids in bed. I was very excited all day long, and I got a drink, and I smoked then. I got my cigarettes, got a new pack of cigarettes, got a Coke, got some ice, you know, got myself all comfortable in the chair. You know, I'm ready for the giant alcoholic amends, because, boy, this should be a long evening. And my husband sat down across from me, and he just said, Larcene, you know, for the pain I caused you with all my drinking, I am sincerely sorry, and I'm going to do my very best to make that up to you and show you by, you know, by living amends. And he was done. I mean, I didn't even get half a cigarette out of that. I was very, very upset. And I thought, that's how they do it in AA. Simple, simple, simple. Just say you're sorry and move on down the highway, you know. And again, you know, I'm very new in my program, and, you know, and I didn't, you know, my husband made amends for himself. It wasn't for me. You know, it's what he had to do to clean up his side of the street. And actually, you know, that's the best amends I've ever heard from that day to this. You know, he just took responsibility for what he did. You know, so if we list all the grievances, you know, again, one more time, what does that accomplish? What does that show? It doesn't do anything. You know, and all he said, and he didn't even say he was sorry. He just said, I'll make it up to you, and I'm, you know, and, you know, by my living amends. You know, he didn't try this, because I'm sorry is not an action. You know, I don't know that I'm sorry is even an amends. An amends is when you're willing to make what you did wrong right. And that requires action on your part. And sometimes the only way you can make the wrong that you did right is by your living amends today, by doing it differently today. If you yell and scold and, you know, and are mean to your family or whatever, you're just saying I'm sorry every time you do it doesn't change anything that's going on. I learned that the hard way. How it changed for me was stopping that behavior. My 10-second rule. You know, if I think I have to say something negative, leave the room. Go in the bathroom. I'd yell at the toilet and the sink about, you know, the stuff I thought, rather than dump that stuff on them. Again, it's practice. It's how I had to do to get out of it until I don't even have to say it anymore. That doesn't become necessary. Because how this program works for me is practice, 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 practice. That's just the only way I ever get it. The only way I ever get it. No one has ever said to me, Larcene, you go home and you do this and this will work, and it works for me that way. Because I never do it that way right away. You know, I love meetings. I hear wonderful things at meetings. Really just... gosh, I'm at the meeting. You're ever at the meeting, you just know that that's the answer, you know, and that's what's going to work for you. But amazingly enough, on the transformation on the drive home, somewhere when I put my hand on the doorknob, the Al-Anon just goes sucking right out of the back of my head, you know, and my control, and I'm in charge, and I'm the queen of the roost here, you know, flies back in, you know, the front of my head, and all that wonderful stuff that I picked up at the meeting just flies right out, you know, because again, you just don't get it that fast. It just doesn't. It takes practice. I had to learn to be quiet. I had to learn to shut up. I had to learn to go in the bathroom and yell and scream and rant and rave and not dump it on them. You know, and that was the practice that I got to do till this practice became a regular routine in my life. You know, and meetings. I can't say enough good stuff about meetings. I remember the very first time, of course, you know, when I started going to meetings, boy, I had my groups and I was at every, I never missed a meeting. I didn't miss a meeting. If my kids were in Little League, as soon as the Little League game was over, uniforms and all, we'd go over to the meeting, you know. And if we came late, they didn't care, you know, they let me in, and I never missed a meeting. And I remember the very first time I missed a meeting, and I don't know why I missed it, but I missed it. And so I saw Gene at the next meeting, and Gene says, you weren't at the meeting last week. And I'm like, yeah, whatever reason I had. And he goes, you will not believe what happened at the meeting. You will not believe it. It was incredible. And I'm like, what? And he goes, I can't tell you because you weren't there. You know? Dang, that will drive you nuts. You know, that will drive me nuts anyway, you know, and stuff. And that's the deal. You might miss it. You might miss the message you need to hear at the meeting. You know, that's why it's so important for us to go. You might miss the message. You know, and meetings again, too. That's where you see the whites of people's eyes. You can talk on the phone, you know, the internet thing. I mean, you know, whatever. You get bored, you get knocked off or whatever. But at the meeting, you know, you see people. You see their faces. You know what's going on with them. They know what's going on with you. You know, and I'm here to tell you, you know, I love going to meetings. I really and truly do. But every Monday night is my home group meeting, and that's my big meeting, and I love everybody at that meeting. But every Monday night, I get home from work, and it starts. You don't need to go tonight. You can skip tonight. You know, you had a hard day today. Just stay home. You don't need to go. Every freaking Monday night it happens. I don't know why. It's just that little voice is just in the back of my mind trying to talk me out of going. But that's a lot of times why I have a commitment at a meeting, you know, because I have to go. You know, and Monday night it's not even necessary for me to have a commitment because I made a commitment that that's my home group. And when I am home, I do not miss Monday night. Now, there are exceptions. If our anniversary happens to fall on Monday night, we'll go out to our anniversary dinner or do whatever, you know, type of thing is going on like that. But as a rule, I do not miss that meeting. You know, and the same thing with my other meetings. That's why it's important to take on commitments if that's what it takes to get you to the meeting. But the meetings, that's where it's happening. That is where it's happening. And it's also really important for me, too, because it's just not about me. It's about the new people that are walking in the door. Because what if nobody was there when I walked into my first meeting because they listened to their little voice say, you don't need to go tonight. You've been there all this other time. Let somebody else take care of the deal. You know, that's my responsibility to be there. You know, we talk about, you know, our declaration when anyone anywhere reaches out. You know, I always want the hand of Al-Anon and Alateen to be there. And it's my hand that's supposed to be there because God, it was there for me when I walked in the door. And it's really, really important that I'm there for the new people, you know, when they walk in the door. You know, and how long do you know, We do newcomers meeting at my Monday night meeting, and inevitably people will say at the newcomer meeting who, you know, because we have a newcomer meeting which is from 7 to 7:30 and the regular meeting 7:30 to 9 o'clock. And so we do the newcomer meeting. Inevitably when I do the newcomer meeting, a newcomer will say to me, well, how long do you have to go to meetings? You know, I mean, that's the first thing we want to know is when do we get out of here? You know, that's the first thing we want to know, you know. And it's the standard, you have to go to meetings until you don't want to go to meetings, you know, or you have to go to meetings until you want to go to meetings, and then you don't have to go to the meetings. And they, of course, don't understand that, and that's perfectly fine. You just say, just keep coming back. You know, and we just tell people, you know, come for 6 weeks, you know, and then if you don't find some relief here within 6 weeks, we'll great, you know, just happily refund your misery. You can have it all back and go on out the door. And, you know, and that's kind of the way that works, you know, and then my part three, which I'm going to have very limited time for because I talk so much on all the other thing, you know, what it's like today is hope. You know, and I have a little saying thing that I keep in one of my books, and it says, you know, they say you can live a month or two without food and a few weeks without water and even a few minutes without air, but you can't live for 1 second without hope. You know, and that is the gift that is here that is just, to me, absolutely positively unbelievable is the hope that we get here. And it is absolutely phenomenal to me. And, you know, and the success you have in Al-Anon if you have that hope. You know, success in Al-Anon isn't if somebody's sober or any of that other kind of crap. You know, success in here is that you're doing the deal for yourself. That it's all about, you know, that you're just working these, you know, doing the next right thing, regardless of whether there's sobriety or whatever. You can find happiness. You absolutely can. You know, and obedience to the unenforceable. I love that expression. See, and obedience, the word obedience. Now, obedience is an Al-Anon word, not an AA word at all, but it's an Al-Anon word. And one more, you know, and that's the part that just blows me about this program is to watch people do this stuff, struggle, sometimes through really painful, painful experiences, and they go through that because they want to get well. You know, and what about a fourth step and a fifth step? Who makes that, you know, why are we truthful about that? You could lie about it. Who's going to know? You don't have to tell everything. You know, but one more time, it's the obedience to the unenforceable. We do it. There's no police here. There's nobody, you know, Al-Anon police, even though some people think that's their job. There really aren't any, you know, and stuff. And what makes us do these things? What makes us do these things? You know, it's because of the examples that we see before us. You know, we see these people getting well, and we want to have that in our life. So we're willing to do that stuff. You know, you can lie. You can say, oh, I went to 16 meetings this week. There's nobody checking up on you. You know, but if you're honest about the deal that's going on, then you will get well. You absolutely, positively will get well. You know, and serenity, isn't that what we all strive for here? Positively, you know. And again, the serenity prayer, God grant me the serenity. Serenity is what makes me, you know, have the wisdom to know the difference. When I have that serenity in my life, I absolutely positively know what is my business and what is not my business. You know, and the truth. Again, the truth is a huge deal for me. It's what it's all about for me. It's what it's, you know, because it was such a lie for me before. Maybe that's why it's so important for me now, because that was such a big fat lie before. Just always lying, making up stuff, doing whatever. And the truth is what sets you free here. You know, to thine own self be true. Don't let anybody take that away from you. Don't let anybody ever take that away from you. You know, and why do people quit coming? I have a friend, Bob F., and he's an AA, and I love this guy to death. And he says people quit coming to Al-Anon and Alcoholics Anonymous because they quit being amazed. You know, and I don't ever want to quit being amazed. You know, and sometimes, you know, when I'm not amazing myself, I just go to a meeting, because there's plenty of amazing stuff going on in a meeting. You know, because if I'm not amazing myself, then you're amazing me. Because it's the people I thought would never make it here, when I see them get up and share something really profound and watch them progress and grow in the program, that's amazing. That is remarkable. You know, so keep being amazed. Keep coming and putting yourself in situations where you can be amazed by other people's progress and how well they're doing here. You know, and change is what's going on all the time. We don't, you know, and I have a really good friend, and I don't know if you guys have ever heard Scott R., because he talks all over the place, and he's just an absolute riot. And he always says how they always say, people in the program don't like change. And he goes, that's not true. And Scott is absolutely right. He says, we just don't like change we don't like. You know, if it's good change, we love it. You know, if you're going to get a big raise, or this is going to go on, or, you know, you're going to meet the man of your dreams, or, you know, all your dreams are coming true, we love that kind of change. It's just change we don't like. And one more time, sometimes the change we don't like is what's going to be the best for us down the road. One more time, did you turn your will and your life over to God today? You know, and if you did, then you got to accept some of the stuff that's going to come along down the path. And some of the change isn't fun. You know, when people get sick and have terrible stuff happen to them, no picnic. You know, and again, one more time, sometimes life just isn't fair. It just isn't fair. And that's just kind of what goes on with it. You know, and choices, boy, do we, you know, we always have choices. And I think that's one of the things that the disease of alcoholism robs us of. Somewhere along the line, you think you're stuck. You think you have to do this deal this way, and you don't. I don't care what's going on in your life. You always have a choice. And sometimes the deal is that it's not an easy choice. Sometimes choices are difficult to make. Sometimes if you decide that you don't want to stay married anymore, that's a hard choice to make. But sometimes but it's a choice you have. You know, you're not stuck. You don't have to be anywhere you don't want to be. If you're willing to make the choice and take the sacrifices, or, you know, and the steps that you may have to take to make that choice happen. And one more time, you got to ask yourself, what's the worst that can happen, and can you live with it? I remember when my mom finally decided to divorce my dad. My dad's a very violent person, and he's always telling us how he's going to kill us if we leave, you know, and he was always telling my mom that kind of stuff. And I remember going over to see my mom, and I go, Mom, aren't you afraid that Dad's going to kill you? And she said, you know what? She said, I've gotten to a point in my life where I'd rather be dead than live this way one more day. You know, and sometimes that's where you got to go. Sometimes that's where you got to go. You know, and faith and spirituality, boy, that's like, you know, one more time, it's the whole God thing. You know, my sponsor says something, and I know she got it from somebody else, but it's religion is for people who believe in hell, and spirituality is for people who have been there. You know, and I absolutely, absolutely, again, I was not brought up in any kind of religious anything or whatever, but I understand that. I positively understand that. You know, and as far as, you know, we talk about miracles, you know, and all this other kind of stuff. You know, what do you need to see to believe? I don't know. But when you have faith, you have faith. And I've got another little saying that I read somewhere that I keep in one of my books. And it says, for the truly faithful, no miracle is necessary. And for those who doubt, no miracle is sufficient. You know, and if you don't believe, you don't believe. And nothing's going to change your mind about it if you don't want to see it. But, you know, I see you guys, and I see miracles around me all the time. Just miracles around me all the time. I have no doubt that God's working overtime around here all the time. You know, and God, how important is God? God, he is everything to me, you know, and he knows everything. But I think God takes a bad rap in the program sometimes. I mean, people throw around God's name for responsibility for stuff. I always like when people go, God doesn't give you more than you can handle. Crapola. You know, I mean, there is lots of stuff that's going on, you know, that you know, how can someone handle a child with cancer? You know, how can someone handle a spouse that's been killed in an automobile accident? How can somebody handle that? God gives that to you because you can handle it? Oh, thanks. Thanks a lot. You know, I can't believe in a God like that. The God that I know, there's lots of things that happen that are bad. You know, and what I know today is there's not anything that doesn't happen to me that God won't help me handle. the best that I have to with whatever's going on. But does God give it to me because he thinks I can carry the load more than you can? I can't believe in a God like that. I just don't, and I don't think that God's that way. You know, and I always like it when things happen to you and people go, oh, God must want you to learn something. You know, oh, yeah, he doesn't want you to learn. He just wants me to learn, huh? You know, well, maybe I'll show you something so God can teach you something too. You know, let's play that game, you know. They're, you know, that God just isn't there for me. You know, the God I know wants us all to be happy, joyous, and free. You know, and life is life, and it goes on. And I can't believe you can have happiness if you don't have, you know, anger, you know. I mean, there's just opposite things that just have to be there to make this world function the way that it functions. You know, and one more time, you know, I just know that no matter what's going on in my life, when I have prayed to God and asked him to show me the way to go, he showed me the way to go. You know, through you, through whatever. I haven't always walked through it really gracefully, and sometimes I've been kicking and screaming the whole way through or whatever. But God will take me through it. I know that God will take me through it, and I know he will take you through it too. You know, and gratitude. Boy, you know, that's looking for the good in everything. And there, and my gratitude list just grows every single solitary day. I am just, my gratitude knows no bounds anymore. You know, and how do you pay back? You don't. There's just no way to pay back, you know, all the good stuff that's going on. You know, and happiness, one more time. You know, I always depended on other people to make me happy. And I learned in Al-Anon, happiness is really an inside job. It comes from the inside. You can't run happiness outside here and it won't go in. It comes out, and you can have put it on other people. But it's an inside job. It has to come from within. You have to look at your own self to see, you know, what the deal that's going on there. And, you know, and laughter and humor, you know, as you guys know, you know, it's become a big deal in my life. It's just because if you're not laughing at yourself, you're missing the joke of the century. You are absolutely missing the joke. I amaze myself at the stupidity of the things that I do. And I remember the first time I heard myself laugh out loud after I was in Al-Anon for a little while. Such a foreign voice to me. I was going to a potluck thing, and I made this dessert, and it had a crusty edge around it. And of course, it didn't look very nice because the crusty edge got burnt. So I had to make it perfect because I was going to a potluck. God forbid they don't think my dessert is perfect. So I go all around the edge and cut the burnt crusty edge off, and I tilt the dessert this way over the sink and go, and the whole dessert, boing, right down the garbage disposal. And my instantaneous thought was, how can I get it from the garbage disposal back into the, you know, because I got to fix it, right? And because of the absurdity of that thought, I laughed out loud. I heard a voice laughing out loud. And I turned around because I had, that's how long it had been since I heard myself laugh out loud. Laugh out loud from inside of here. And that's a gift. That's a gift that you get here. You know, you don't get that anywhere else. You know, and from that day to this, I do ridiculously stupid stuff all the time. And it's a big deal. And when I, you know, and again, the look, you know, because it's easy for me. You know, as much as the laughter and the humor is important for me, I can be dead bone serious about stuff sometimes. You know, I always want to have the topic. When I lead at the meeting, I always want the topic of the meeting to be, what stick is up your butt? You know, because that's how it is for me. I get a stick up my butt about something, and I am on task and focused, and we can't look anywhere else, and by God, we can't have any fun. And I don't like that anymore. It's not comfortable for me anymore. I don't want to live that way anymore. But I go back there all the time. I don't know why. How long do you have to be there before that stops? I don't know. That's why it's so important to keep coming to the meetings, I guess. Why it's so important for me to talk to a sponsor so that I keep that stick out of my butt. Keep it light. Have some friggin' fun here, you know. And another thing, you know, I read one time, and it's important. If you stay rigid, you will break. And I keep that in mind all the time when I find myself being rigid, because I will break. I will absolutely positively break, and I just live that. And, you know, and I just kind of want to close up, you know, with a couple other things. Living in the now. You know, I heard one guy share one time, he said, you know, and I know he got this from somebody else again. I got nothing original. But today is a gift, and that's why they call it a present. You know, and that's why it's so important. How much stuff do I miss every day because I'm not living in the now? You know, one of my favorite things I was talking to Judy is I get a manicure and a pedicure every couple of weeks, and I love the pedicure because you get a foot rub, you know, and you get a foot rub from a professional. Oh, really good. And but I found myself not too long ago, because there was a lot of stuff going on with my children, and I was very concerned about that I was getting my foot rub, and then she tapped my foot, which means you put your foot down because your foot rub is over. And I missed the foot rub. And I was very upset about it, you know, because this is why I come here for that. You know, and I don't want to miss that kind of stuff. You know, I miss where I was right then, right now, because I was in worry and fear about what was going on with my kids and what was going to happen with them. I missed my only every 2 week foot rub. Now, she is not going to give me another foot rub because I want a do-over, you know, and stuff. That's not the way that life works. I missed the foot rub. Just like when I'm on those vacations and I'm on those hikes, I miss the streams and I miss the flowers, and I have to look at my vacation pictures to see where the heck I've been. You know, don't miss the stuff. Don't miss the package because it's not wrapped the way that you want it to be. You miss the gift that you're getting. You know, and one more, just a couple more words, unconditional love. Again, one of the most important things in the world for me here. You know, and another, you know, another saying someone once told me, why is it that the people who need love the most seem to deserve it the least? You know, or at least in my mind, you know, one more time, because it's not the way the package is wrapped for me. It's not the way that I think it's. And again, the meaning behind what unconditional love means. You know, you guys taught me that. You guys taught me that. About taking that home with, taking the program home with you, the absolute most important thing you can do as far as I'm concerned. Because one more time, talking at the meetings is no big deal. Because we know the words to say, and you know how to say it at the meeting, and you behave at a meeting, boy, you know, you wouldn't behave at home, like, you know, and bring that and behave at a meeting that way. You wouldn't let anybody see you do that. You wouldn't let anybody see the voice you use at home, use that at a meeting. You know, and that's why it's so important to take the things you learn from the meeting into your home. Because that's where the rewards are. You know, when you get to take this and actually practice these principles in all your affairs, your life just gets good. Despite your best efforts to muck it up, your life will just get good, because that's the way it works, because God's working in your life, because God is absolutely positively working in your life. And I just want to share with my favorite page in the ODAT, and this is a page I read practically every day because it's what keeps me on focus and what pretty much tries to keep me on task in the program, because it's really important for me to know what my place is in here. And the first time I read this, it was just, it meant everything to me, because it just tells you exactly who I am. It's January the 21st, and it says, if I can see myself clearly and honestly in relation to my present circumstances, I will not become the victim of self-pity or resentment. If I do what I should, I will be at peace with myself. It is only when I compare my lot in life with that of others that the destructive emotion of self-pity is allowed to engulf me. It is only by taking offense at what others do that I will be afflicted with resentment. If I feel what I am doing is right, I will not be dependent on the admiration or applause of others. It is gratifying, but not essential to my contentment. I will learn to judge my own motives, to evaluate my own actions, so that little by little I can bring them into line with my standards and ideals. Today's reminder, nothing has the power to hurt my feelings and stir up unwholesome emotions in me unless I allow it. I will do what is given me to do. I will do it as well as I can. That will be my inner security against which all outside battering will be powerless. Labor not as one who is wretched, nor yet as one who would be pitied or admired. Direct yourself to one thing only, to put yourself in motion and to check yourself at all times. I can't thank you guys enough for the faith that you had in me to come and do this. I can't tell you how grateful I am that it's over. And I love you all. You know, I've got a little bitty wooden candle that I keep in my kitchen. It's a little wooden block, and it's got a little wooden candle on it. And it says, a candle loses nothing of its light by lighting another candle. The world just burns a little brighter. I want to thank you guys from the bottom of my heart for lighting my candle and for having me. Thanks.